please feel free to ask questions and interact with the class. So we had to skip a week last week because I was too chicken to drive in the snow that we had last week. So I had to make a decision at 8:30, and you know, I decided to call it off. So my plan is to add on this week, you know, at the end of the semester, so we actually will make up for that lecture. At some point, we'll have to plan a time for your presentation. So at this point, you should have, you know, got started on your project, and you should be, you know, probably well underway working through your project. So at some point, we'll all, I think, get together. We'll probably organize something like a symposium where, you know, we'll make a day out of it, and each of you will give a maybe 15-minute or 20-minute presentation on your stuff, and then I'll collect the written versions of that. So I'm not sure exactly when that will be taking place, and we may need to be flexible about this, but anyway, it will come probably at some point in April. But anyway, we'll see about that. I have your homework back, and I'll give it to you at the end of this lecture. If I don't forget, but if I forget, just please remind me. I want to give it back to you, and I want to make some remarks about it. And here's homework number four. Two problems in chapter three and two problems in chapter four. Chapter four is where I'm going to be today, and that is about the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity. And I think that you'll be able to do number one immediately after today's lecture, and number five you may need to wait a little bit in order to get the relevant material from the lectures. So my initial intention when we stopped, whenever that was to finish off chapter three on hypersurfaces by talking about junction conditions. And I was all keen on doing that because I think there are some really interesting applications associated with that. But in the interest of time, and because I'm getting anxious to get to black holes eventually, I decided I would skip that. So that's something I'll leave for you for your own education to study in your own time. And what I'll do today is to just go into chapter four on Lagrangians and Hamiltonians. So we'll do that today, and well, I'll get started right now. So I want to talk about this, the Lagrangian and Hamiltonian formulation of general relativity, because I think that's something that's really essential to a proper education in GR. But on top of that, I think there's some ulterior motives. The Hamiltonian formulation turns out to be a good handle on how to define mass and angular momentum in general relativity, and I want to bring out this connection when we're done with it, and that will help me when we talk about black holes in, you know, defining properly what the mass of a black hole is and what the angular momentum of a black hole is. So that's the reason for doing this, but I think, you know, the main reason for doing that is, I think, the intrinsic interest in formulating GR through a Lagrangian formulation first and a Hamiltonian formulation that, of course, is derived from the Lagrangian formulation. And before I turn to GR, what I would like to do is to just review a little bit the Lagrangian formulation of field theory. And we're going to do it in curved space-time, which might be new. I'm assuming here that you've had an occasion to study the Lagrangian formulation of fields in flat space-time, perhaps in a field theory or, you know, somewhere else, in a field theory course or somewhere else. And here I'll just, you know, take that and promote it to curved space-time. And if you know the first one, the extension to curved space-time is pretty obvious. But I just want to review that first, and then we'll see what needs to be done if you're going to formulate, you know, a theory of, you know, general relativity through a Hamiltonian form, through a Lagrangian formulation. So let's talk about a field theory. And for concreteness and simplicity here, I'll consider my field to be a scalar field, although everything that I say could be, in fact, you know, extended, you know, generalized to fields that could be either vectorial or tensorial, and we'll do it for a tensor field in a moment, or even spinner fields. I mean, spinner fields require technically a little bit more, you have to handle spinner fields in a certain way, and technically you have to do that carefully, and you need the language to do that. But the basic ideas behind formulating a Lagrangian formulation of a spinner field theory are, basically the same. So I'll just do it here for a scalar field, because that clearly is the simplest, situation. So the idea is to, is to write down the Lagrangian for your favorite field theory from which you construct an action, and then the variation of the action given certain rules gives you the classical field equations for that field theory. So the setup is something like this. We're going to be working in a finite domain of a space-time. So that's going to be a four-dimensional region V that's going to be bounded by a boundary delta V, which is going to be a closed three-dimensional surface. And the idea is that we want to work in this domain and figure out the field equations in this domain. And of course, the domain is arbitrary. We can extend it arbitrarily. We can make it small. We can make it big. We can patch up different domains. The idea of having a finite domain, though, is useful for specifying the rules of the variation principle. And that turns out to be important. So we're going to be dealing with scalar field. And I'll use the notation Q, and that's reminiscent of, Lagrangian mechanics. Q is going to be the notation for a scalar field that would be, a function of space-time coordinates, whatever they are, space-time coordinates x alpha. And so we have a scalar field theory. It can vary with time. It can vary with space. And the field can vary with space and time. And what we need to formulate a variational principle for that theory is a Lagrangian that will be integrated over space-time to get the action. So what I'm talking about actually is a Lagrangian density for the field. And usually that's denoted curly L. And curly L, by convention and by assumption, is going to be a function of the field itself and its first derivative. And I won't consider the case where the Lagrangian might actually depend on higher derivatives of the field. That's typically not needed, although for GR, we're going to see that, in fact, the Lagrangian for GR depends on second derivatives of the metric, and there's some interesting complications that arise from that. Okay, so the Lagrangian depends on the field and the derivatives of the field. And one major requirement here, if we're going to have a theory that's going to be generally covariant, is for the Lagrangian to be a scalar function of these things. So you have to make up a scalar out of the vector. So that means typically that you're going to construct the Lagrangian by taking, a scalar that would be formed from that vector. Usually that means you're going to involve the norm of the vector in the Lagrangian, and that would give you the kinetic from the Lagrangian. And then any scalar function of the field itself would give you the potential term of the Lagrangian. And here, of course, you're free to design whatever you wish for your field theory. So this is, importantly, a scalar function. And then the action for the field, is going to be a functional of the field. Of course, it's going to depend on which solution you pick for which field configuration you pick, and the action is going to be a space-time integral of the Lagrangian density. So we turn the Lagrangian density into a Lagrangian by integrating over space, and then we turn that into an action by integrating over time. That's directly reminiscent from Lagrangian mechanics. And then, the idea is that we have a variational principle and the principle says that if you vary the action around the classical path or the classical trajectory or the solution to the classical field equations, you get zero. So you get this, eventual variation of the action to first order if you vary around the classical path. So, and that gives you the field equations for your field theory. And of course, what field equations you get will depend on the choice you make for the Lagrangian density. An important caveat, an important rule, I mean, an important aspect of the variational principle is that not all variations are allowed. What you have to be sure is that all the variations that you consider are such that on the boundary of that domain in which we're working, you get zero radiation. So in Lagrangian mechanics, you would start with a situation at t equals t0, and then you would have another situation configuration at t equals t1, and then you would allow for all possible variations, but they would have to be zero at the initial time and at the final time. Those are the rules of the variational principle in Lagrangian mechanics. Well, the analog to that here is that, well, instead of having just, you know, two boundaries in time, we have a complete space-time boundary, a closed three-dimensional surface, and we're demanding that the variation in the field, when we do the variation, be zero on the boundary. Of course, it's completely arbitrary within the boundary, but this is needed to have a well-posed variational problem. Okay. So the rest is just details. The rest is just, you know, taking this and deriving the Euler-Lagrange equation for your field theory, given the choice of Lagrangian, and we can just, you know, deal with those details with that calculation. And we'll do something very similar for GR in a second. Did you have a question? Yeah. Oh. Well, that's a good point. So here there's no distinction because I'm dealing with a scale field.
Okay, right.
And the covariant derivative of a scale field is the same thing as just the partial derivative. If we were dealing with a vector field, then the assumption would be that, well, the Lagrangian, if it's going to be a scalar, should depend on the covariant derivative of the vector field. And for spinners, you would have to also accommodate that. So, yeah. So here, I didn't want to complicate. Other questions? Okay, so let me go through the procedure of varying the action and then obtaining the field equations in the form of the Euler-Lagrange equation for the field theory. And the procedure is really very straightforward. So we have an action. The action is expressed as a Lagrangian density that depends on Q, and I'll use the notation Q alpha to denote its derivative. The metric here is non-dynamical, so the space-time is fixed. So so the metric is fixed, so I don't have to worry about variations of the metric. We'll do that when we deal with GR in a second. So when we take the variation of the action, what we have to do is to consider variations in Q and variations in its derivative. So we first take the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to Q, and we multiply that by the variation in Q. And then we take the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the derivative of the field, and then we vary that. And then the volume integral of all that. I'm going to do the usual trick of integrating by parts. So this, so the variation of the derivative is the derivative of the variation. And what I'm going to do is to combine those two things into a global derivative that we're going to push to the boundary. So what I'm going to say is that this will be, now I'm going to use covariant derivatives because here I'm dealing with a vector quantity. So I'm going to say that this whole thing is equal to the covariant derivative of the partial derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to Q times the variation of the field minus dq times the covariant derivative of this. So so if I expand this, I get the covariant derivative of this, which has been removed here, and then I get this times the derivative of delta q, which is what it started with. So this is just a matter of mathematical identity. And I'm using covariant derivatives because here I didn't need to distinguish between partial and covariant, but because here I'm actually differentiating a vector, I can in fact convert my partial derivatives into covariant derivatives, and I'm doing everything right. Okay. Well, here we have a total divergence that we're going to push to the boundary, so we're going to use Gauss's theorem and push that to the boundary. And then we're going to loop, gather everything together inside the volume integral. And inside the volume integral, we'll have two terms that multiply delta q, and that's where you use the fact that delta q is arbitrary to conclude something about the nature of the integrand inside the volume integral. So if we continue, so I'm going to take this and use Gauss's theorem to express that as a surface integral on the boundary here. I was integrating all of this within V. And what we get is the partial derivative of Lagrangian with respect to Q alpha times delta Q integrating over the surface. And you remember what we talked about, remember the surface element discussion that we had before. So that's what happens when we use Gauss's theorem to convert the volume integral of a divergence to a surface integral. And then we have the remaining terms into the volume integral. And first of all, we get the L dQ, and then we get the covariant derivative of the L dQ alpha. All of that multiplying dQ, and all of that being integrated over the domain V. Well, as usual, the surface integral, the boundary terms in the variation goes away. And they go away because delta Q is required to vanish everywhere on delta V. So there's no contribution from the boundary. And that's why we had to make up this rule, because if we didn't have it, we could not conclude that the boundary term goes away, but we need that to go away for the right answer to come out. So we needed this rule to make this go away. And then, while the argument is standard, you say that here's an integral that must vanish if the variation of the action is to vanish, and it has to vanish for arbitrary variations around the path that you're looking for, around the classic, around the configuration of the field that will become the classical configuration. And if this integral has to vanish for arbitrary choices of delta q, except for that condition that it has to vanish in the boundary, then it must be true that this bracket inside the integral has to vanish all by itself. Otherwise, you could not guarantee that the integral vanishes for arbitrary choices of delta q. And the bottom line is that, this gives you the field equations, and they're known as the field theory or Lagrange equations. And what we have is the statement that this equation must be valid, and this essentially is a statement of the classical field equations for your scalar field theory. So if you want to invent a theory, all you have to do is to write down the Lagrangian, and then you insert the Lagrangian into those equations, and you have your your field equations. And that's the modern way of doing field theory. You just make your Lagrangian, and and you're done. So, for example, if you're dealing with a Klein-Borden equation, Klein-Borden field, then the Lagrangian density, I just want to be sure I get my signs correct. There's going to be an overall factor of minus a half, but for a Klein-Borden field Q, the Lagrangian density is given by this. So this is the choice you make for the kinetic term in the Lagrangian, and that's a vector, that's a scalar quantity that you get from the vector q alpha, which is the derivative of q with respect to alpha. If you want the action to be quadratic in the kinetic, quadratic in the field derivatives, which is typical, well, that's essentially all that you can have in your Lagrangian, and that's the standard kinetic energy term in the Lagrangian. This is the choice that is being made for the potential energy term in the Lagrangian, and here the choice is to make it quadratic, and that defines a free field theory, a field theory that doesn't interact with itself. You could turn that into a more complicated function of q, a nonlinear function of q, or a non-quadratic function of q, and that would define a self-interacting field theory. For example, lambda 5 to the 4th is a theory that would contain a kinetic term like this, but then would contain a q to the 4th term And that's a standard choice of interacting field theory to learn how to do, fighting diagrams and things like that. And you can complicate the situation even more than that. Instead of having one scalar field, you could have a whole collection of scalar fields, and it could have all sorts of complicated interactions among them. And, in cosmology, people play with models like this. For example, models of inflation are typically based on a scalar field theory with a potential energy that has the right kind of shape that would then produce the right kind of expansion, during inflation. That sort of thing. So basically, inventing a theory is all about writing down the plausible Lagrangian, and then, you explore the consequences of this by plugging that into the Euler Lagrange equations. And I think I'll just leave it for you as an exercise to show that, if you plug that into the Euler Lagrange equations, you get back the Klein-Gordon equation, which takes this form right here. You have the wave operator in curve spacetime acting on the field Q minus m squared Q being zero. So that follows directly from the procedure of substitution into the Euler Lagrange equation. All right, so that was my lightning review of field theory in curved spacetime. And this is something that you can do, for scalar fields, it's all the same. For collecting scalar fields, it's all the same. In the first problem that I'm assigning to you, you're going to have to do it for the electromagnetic field, in which case what plays the role of Q is going to be the vector potential A alpha. And A alpha, in this case, is going to be a vector field. So here you're going to have to think about, the impact of dealing with a vector field when you carry out this procedure. You have to make sure that, the Lagrangian density is a proper scalar function, and you have to go through those steps paying attention to what is a vector, what is a scalar. But you just follow the procedure, and in the end, you end up with Maxwell's equations properly written down in curved space time. All right, yeah, for sure.
There's a hidden assumption about the type of variations we're allowed to consider if we want the derivative to commute with the variation. But I forget what that is. Is it just plain old smoothness of variation, or do you also have to assume smallness?
I think smoothness should be, because I have differentiable functions, and there's no distinction between the derivative of the variation and the variation of the derivative. And I think all you require for that is C1 functions, but you need C2 functions to get, to get the wave equation, to get to satisfy the field equations. But I think those assumptions are pretty mild and not worth worrying about too much. Other questions? Yeah?
The variation of principle for means that the value at boundary can uniquely determine the value in the box.
The question is, the variation principle seems to imply that the value of the field on the boundary fixes the value everywhere within the box, which has a nice, holographic ring to it, but I don't think this is true, because in the sense that if you fix the value of the field on the boundary, and you satisfy this equation, then of course you have specified the field everywhere. But the key is that you still need to satisfy that equation, which comes from the requirement that the action is minimum, right? That you have an extremum of the action when you do that. So I think this equation is still pretty important. But this plus the boundary value of the field is enough to attend the distribution. So I think in that sense your statement is correct, but you still need to satisfy this equation.
How about the connections, the initial problem.
Okay, so here we're doing something slightly different, and it's true also in mechanics, right? When you do the Lagrangian formulation of the mechanics, you sort of momentarily remove the attention from the initial value problem to a two-boundary type problem where you fix the initial configuration and the final configuration. And then eventually you return to the field equations and you reformulate that into an initial value problem. So for the purposes of doing the variation principle here, we're doing also something similar where we say we're going to momentarily do something different from the initial value problem. And instead of doing that, we're going to specify the field everywhere on the boundary. And that replaces, that changes the nature of the problem a little bit. But once you're, when you're at the level of having field equations, you can then change the interpretation and change the focus and say, we're going to look at this together with initial values for Q and its time derivative and formulate and specify the solution in terms of that type of boundary table. So it's just a momentary thing that we do here in order to get that, and after that we're about to do whatever we want to. And I think those issues are there in mechanics, and they just appear in this way. Okay. Any more questions? Okay, well, let's do it with GR.
And the GR story is more or less that, except that there are more details and the calculations are a little bit longer and there's some interesting issues that arise because of the fact that in GR, the Lagrangian, that is the starting point of general relativity, is something that involves not just the metric and its first derivative, but it involves also second derivatives, which means that the nature of the variation principle is, is a little bit more subtle. So we need to go through that and think about it. Well, let me just write down the action for GR, and then I'll discuss it. So typically, so what you want your theory to contain is, gravity and matter. So I'll take the point of view that there's going to be matter in our space-time, perhaps described by a scalar field, and there's going to be gravity in our space-time, and we want to consider, an action that will contain both gravity and the matter fields, and we want to do a variation with respect to gravity to get the field equations for gravity, and we'll want to do a variation for the matter fields to get the matter field equations. So our action, big action for everything, will contain a gravitational term plus a matter term. And I'll return to the matter term in just a second, but now I want to focus on the gravitational part of the action. And I'll write it down like this. So we're still working within a finite domain V for the reasons I specified before. And the famous gravitational action is the one that's called Hilbert-Einstein, and the one that was first written down by Hilbert and shown by him to produce the right field equations. Except that the story doesn't quite end there, and that's something that was discovered a little bit later on, that in order to have a well-posed variational principle for gravity, you also need to include a boundary term to the action, something which was not necessary in the case of the scalar field theory. And the boundary term will involve the extrinsic curvature on the boundary, the trace of the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. There's going to be an epsilon factor that will take care of the fact that sometimes the boundary is time-like, sometimes the boundary is space-like, and you need to indicate this with an indicator, epsilon, which is plus or minus one, depending on whether the boundary is space-like or time-like. And then what we need to do is to integrate all of this on the boundary with, an appropriate measure on the boundary, which is given by the induced metric on the boundary. So the first term is famous. It's called the Einstein-Hilbert action. The second term, I think is now well known, but it's the sort of thing that was gradually introduced into the gravitational action after people realized that straightforward variation based only on the Hilbert term didn't quite do the right job, and you needed to insert the boundary term to correct that. We'll go through that story in a moment. But it turns out that the boundary term is extremely important in order to associate things like mass and angular momentum to the Hamiltonian of space-time. So when we go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian formulation, and we write down an expression for the gravitational Hamiltonian, it turns out that all of the physical information about the space-time, like mass and angular momentum and other conserved quantities, is in fact produced by the boundary term. The bulk term in gravitational action almost is trivial, as we're going to say later, it's pure constraint. And that's important in its own right, but that means that for all classical solutions to the Einstein field equations, the bulk term in the Hamiltonian is actually zero, and all of the information is contained in the boundary term. So the boundary term is important, first of all, to guarantee a well-closed variation principle for gravity, and but also in terms of extracting physical information from the Hamiltonian, the boundary term is everything. The constant in front is just there to calibrate the unit, so that's the thing that's going to give rise to the famous factor of 8 pi in the Einstein field equations. So we put the factor here instead of putting it in front of the matter term. You want to hear the story of David and Albert? Hilbert and Einstein? Yeah, good. The old story used to be that Hilbert actually anticipated Einstein by something like 5 days, that he would actually, that he actually wrote the Einstein field equations first 5 days before Einstein actually did it. And that's the standard story that has been repeated and, you know, put in textbooks and biographies of Einstein and all of that. And I think 10 years ago or so, the story was shown to be untrue. And I think that's an interesting story. So the way it goes is something like this. So Einstein wanted to combine special relativity and gravity starting in, 1907 or so. That's when he first started to think about the principle of equivalence and how gravity would fit into a relativistic description. And then he didn't do very much about this for a while, but in 1913 or so, really got started big time in trying to formulate, a relativistic theory of gravity based on non-Euclidean metrics and all of that stuff. And between 1913 and 15, he did an awful lot of work on this, but he got confused for a long time about the meaning of general covariance. And for a while, he thought the general covariance had to be given up, that is field equations, if he wanted to have, compatibility with the Newtonian limit. For a while, he thought that he would have to, give up on general covariance, and he, invented a sort of class of coordinate systems that would be compatible with the Newtonian limit, and he formulated the theory based on that. And in 1913, he wrote a famous paper with Grossman on that, and he continued to work on this. He wasn't very satisfied, and it's until, it's only in 1915 that he realized that he had sort of made a conceptual mistake, and he came back to general covariance, and in rapid succession, in November of 1915, in about 3 weeks, he published one paper, and then the next, and the third, and in the first paper, he had the vacuum field equations, and he had, understood, finally, the compatibility of general covariance with general relativity. And then in the second paper, he actually wrote the field equations with matter, except that they were the wrong ones. Those equations that he wrote down at that time was Ricci equals stress energy tensor. He didn't have the trace term in there. And then finally, the next week, everything was in place. He had recognized the need for the trace term in the field equations, and then everything was complete. The theory was finally, in its final formulation. Well, at some point in 1913, Hilbert became interested. In 1915, Hilbert started to be interested in all that, and he started to work on this. For a while, Einstein and Hilbert were corresponding. Albert was very candid about his progress and all that stuff, and Hilbert was just, going through all of this and then making work on his own. And eventually, Einstein became a little bit angry because Hilbert clearly was trying to beat him to the punchline and formulate the theory before he was. He was finished with it. And given that Einstein had to invent the notion that gravity was all about metrics and pseudo-Riemannian space-times and all that stuff. You know, Hilbert was really trying to encroach on this territory. I think you can argue that. But anyway, there's the notion that that Hilbert published a paper 5 days before Einstein that contained the final version of the field equations, and because the paper had a date on it that was November 20th as opposed to November 25th, the date that Einstein actually published his own paper, while the standard story was that based on the variational principle like this that was probably formulated by Hilbert, Hilbert got field equations first.
Well, about 12 years ago,
the original manuscript that was submitted to whichever journal Hilbert published was discovered in the archive of that journal completely by accident. And it turns out that there's a big difference between the submitted manuscript, which was submitted on November the 20th, and the final form of the published manuscript, which was published only, I think, in March the following year. Huge changes had been made to the original version to get the final version. The field equations appear in the final version, not in the proofs. The action appears in the original manuscript. But it seems as if in the original manuscript, Hilbert was still confused about general covariance, the same way that Einstein was maybe a month prior. And he had the action, but he didn't have the field equations. And then in the final published version that came out well after Einstein's own paper and well after the submission of Einstein's paper, finally, the variation principle was there, but also the correct form of the field equations appeared. So now, the case for claiming that Hilbert actually anticipated Einstein is much weaker, and in fact, you can build a narrative where Einstein and Hilbert continued to correspond, and Hilbert took notice of Einstein's final paper and was able to get the final form of the field equations after manipulating the Hilbert action, something that he didn't do before, at least didn't do in the manuscript form that he submitted, 5 days before Einstein. So, I think that story now has become much more interesting and more complex, and I would tend to believe that Einstein, certainly was completely independent in deriving the field equations, and the notion that Hilbert might have actually discovered the field equation. You can still maybe make the case that Hilbert actually knew the field equations but didn't bother to write them down in his manuscript, but that seems a little bit unlikely, although at that point it's all about speculating about what really happened. But anyway, that's the story of David and Albert. And if you want, so there was a paper in Science that was published, I think, in 97 that I quote in my book that explains all of that. Those are the three people who actually, discovered the original manuscript and were able to rebuild the correct historical narrative behind those events. So I think that's sort of interesting. All right. So, well, let's go away from history and do the variational principle associated with that. So what we need here is, we need to import for a tensor field all the rules that we formulated for the scalar field. And in particular, what we need to make clear is the fact that, as I said before, we're working in a finite domain V bounded by a boundary delta V. And what we're going to do is to do a variation of the metric in that domain. And what we're going to do also is to require that the variation of the metric vanish in the boundary. We're going to consider all possible metric fields inside the domain, but on the boundary of the domain, we're going to require that conditions are fixed. That's the direct analog for GR of what we're doing here for the scalar field. So a very important condition in the variational principle is the condition that says that in whatever coordinate system we pick to do all of this, the variation of the boundary, the variation of the metric on the boundary is going to be zero. And that's very important. And essentially, it's because we want to impose this condition, but only this condition, that gives us a need for a boundary term in the action. We're going to see why that is. We could have chosen to enlarge the class of variations, or rather to restrict it even further by demanding that all derivatives of the metric vanish in the boundary as well. the variation of all derivatives of the metric bench as well. But that would be clearly more than what you do here, and perhaps unnecessary, and perhaps too much. We can require that all the tangential derivatives of the metric vanish on the boundary, because that's exactly the same statement as this. But something that would be too strong, and something that we don't want to do, is to impose that the normal derivative of the metric vanish on the boundary. That would be more than what is needed for the scalar field, and more than we want to impose for the metric variation in this problem. And that's exactly why, because we don't want to impose this extra condition, that's why we need this boundary term right here. All right. Well, the rest is a matter of details. One thing that I might say right now is that, well, given that we have the boundary, we have all of those notions that we've talked about when we're talking about hypersurfaces. We have the notion of intrinsic metric on the boundary. We have intrinsic coordinates on the boundary. We have the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. All of that we're going to use and incorporate in our discussion. And one thing that I might say right now is to say that, well, if we define the induced metric by just taking the space-time metric and, you know, projecting it down to the boundary, given that here we're not thinking of changing the coordinates as we do all of this, we pick a coordinate system that is fixed once and for all. If the variation of g on the boundary is zero, the variation of the intrinsic metric on the boundary is zero as well, which means that the boundary has a metric and the metric is not changing. So this is a boundary with a fixed metric. The variation of the boundary of the metric inside the domain is not changing the value of the induced metric on the boundary. So an important aspect of the following discussion is that, well, we never need to worry about changing the varying the metric on the boundary. That's guaranteed to be zero. That variation is zero by virtue of this condition right here. Although we're going to have to think a little bit harder about what to do with the extrinsic curvature. That's something that will have, in fact, the variation of the boundary. Okay. So we need to carry on with the variation, and there, well, there's going to be lots of technical details that we need to plow through, and before I go through that, I would like to summarize some of the rules and some of the sort of helpful results that we can import from before that will come to bear in the calculation. So let me just specify a few things. So for convenience, it turns out that it's useful not to vary with respect to the metric itself, but to do variation with respect to the inverse metric. So what we're going to do is to use the variations associated with the inverse metric instead of those associated with the metric itself. And there's nothing very deep about this. It's just a matter of convenience. And all that we have to recognize here is that, well, those variations are not independent. In fact, this is completely dependent from that and the other way around. So if you, you know, think of a matrix and if you change all the elements, well, you can calculate the inverse to that and you know how the, inverse elements have changed. And in particular, I mean, the statement of non-independence, the statement of dependence simply comes from the requirement that whatever you do, when you multiply the inverse to the metric, you get the identity matrix. And it follows from that that the variation of the metric, there's a minus sign, but it's simply what you get if you lower the indices of the variation of the inverse metric. And the minus sign has to do with the fact that if you take a variation of all this, you get delta G inverse multiplying G plus, you know, G inverse multiplying delta G, all of that being equal to zero. So when you solve for this and you put everything else to the right hand side, you pick up that minus sign. So anyway, so we're going to use this instead of that, and we can relate the two in very simple ways like that. And that's purely a matter of convention and convenience for us to carry on with the variation. Another result that we'll need here is to figure out what happens to the metric determinant when we vary the metric or its inverse. And essentially, that rule comes from the rule that we specified a long time ago about how to differentiate determinants. And I'll just state it here. It turns out that the variation of the metric determinant, or the square root of that, turns out to be, there's a minus sign, there's a factor of 1/2. But it's given by this. And that's the origin, essentially, of the formula where each formula that, in the divergence equation, for example, when you convert the covariant derivative into partial derivatives and square root of factors of g, square root of minus g appear, it all comes from here, and that's something we talked about in the second lecture of the course. Anyway, so the point again is that if you vary the metric or you vary the inverse, the determinant will, carry variation as well, which is not independent from everything else, and you get the variation of the determinant from the variation of the inverse metric through this equation right here. Okay, if we vary the metric or its inverse, we're going to vary a lot of things, including the Christoffel symbols, and including, of course, the Ricci tensor and Riemann tensor and all of those things. So we're going to have to find a way of handling variations of the connection and also variations of the Christoffel symbols. Connection and the Riemann tensor. And one aspect of this that comes out to be very useful is the fact that while we know that Christoffel symbols are the connection is not a tensor field in spacetime, it certainly does not transform as a tensor. The difference between two connections, or the variation of a connection, is in fact a tensor field. And that's something that's really very easy to see. If you change coordinates from x to x prime, and if you work out how the connection transforms, I'll just do it very schematically here. And that's something that I didn't talk about in the lectures, but that's something you can, there's a whole discussion of that in the first sections of the book. What you find is that the connection, of course, does not transform as a scalar. It has the usual type of things that you would get. There would be three of them because we have three indices. There's the usual type of transformation rule that you would get for a tensor field, but then there's something else that in fact depends on second derivatives of the coordinates with respect to the new coordinates. And if you only had this term, then that would be the statement that gamma transforms as a tensor. But this additional piece means that, well, in fact, it does not. There's a leftover piece that prevents gamma from transforming as a tensor. If you don't transform gamma itself, but the difference between two gammas, you'll get this minus that in the transformation rule, and that goes away. And that's the statement that while gamma itself isn't transformed as a tensor, a difference of gammas, a difference between two connections in space-time will transform as a tensor. And in particular, a variation of a connection is something that is a tensor field in space-time. So conclusion here is that the variation of a connection, which occurs when you vary the metric, is a tensor field. And when we proceed with the calculation, I'm going to do things like taking covariant derivatives of that, which I'm allowed to do because it's a tensor field. And the idea of the variation is that we start with a reference metric, and we vary around it. And all of the tensorial operations, like, the nature of the variational principle is you say that, well, there's going to be a reference metric, which, will be identified later as the classical solution to the Einstein field equations, and we do the variation on that. When we vary the connection, we say that, well, the connection is the original connection plus the variation in the connection. And what I'm going to say is that, well, all the operations of covariant differentiation and all of the tensorial rules that I'm going to just use in the process of doing the calculation, well, we'll refer to the original metric, the reference metric. So what I want to say is that covariant differentiation here when we go through the variation, we'll refer to the reference metric. G alpha beta. But I won't put bars because that would just clutter notation and it's unnecessary. So for example, in the equations that I'll go through later on, we're gonna have covariant derivatives of this guy. And it's gonna have to be clear that I'm allowed to covariantly differentiate that because it is a tensor field. And also the connection that I use when I differentiate that is gonna be the reference connection, the one that later will be identified with you know, the classical connection that we would get from solving the field equations, the one that's gonna be compatible with the reference metric, again, the solution to the field equations. Okay. So I think those are all the rules that I'm gonna need, and now I just need to proceed with the calculation. And well, you know, it's gonna take some time to work through all of that. Okay, so I'll start out with just the bulk term in the action. And we'll see what we get. So the first thing that I'll do is to make this a little bit more explicit. And let's see, how do I want to do that? Right, I'll write it as the inverse metric, the Ricci tensor, and then we have root G and V for X. When I vary this, I have to vary everything inside the integral. So the first thing that I need to do is to vary the inverse metric. Then I vary the determinant and according to the rule I just wrote down. So that gives us a minus a half square root of g, g alpha beta, and the Ricci tensor comes along for the ride. And the final thing I have to do is to vary the Ricci tensor. And if you look at the first term, the first integral, what we see is that, well, we have Ricci minus a half times the trace of Ricci. That's the Einstein tensor. That multiplies delta G alpha, that multiplies root G, and we're integrating. And then we have the second term that involves the variation of the Ricci tensor that we also integrate over the domain D. So if we didn't have that term, we'd be home free. Because, you know, demanding that the variation be of the gravitational part of the action under arbitrary changes of the metric be zero would tell us that, well, for vacuum, the Einstein field equations would be Einstein tensor equals zero. So it seems that here we have everything we need to make the left-hand side of the field equations. The matter action is going to give us what we need to make up the right-hand side. But, you know, we still have this leftover term that, you know, perhaps, well, needs to be worked out, and perhaps will give us nothing. Well, the story should be so simple, but it's not. So we're going to need to work on this and see what it gives us, and all of the issues of integrating by parts and dealing with the boundary will appear. Okay. So now I have to work on this calculation, the variation of this. So we vary the metric, we get a variation in the connection, and eventually we get variation of the Riemann tensor, and then we get a variation of the Riemann tensor. So in principle, we have to go through all of those steps. And you could, you know, you could do it the hard way, or you could do it my way, and they're not the same. I'll do it the easy way. And doing it the easy way will be to, again, rely on the fact that the variation of the connection is a tensor. And the easy way also will be to say that I'm going to work out an expression for this in local reference frame that's going to be locally Lorentzian. I'm going to work at point P and work it out at point P where the metric can be assumed to be Minkowski and where the connection can be assumed to be zero. And I'm going to work out the tensorial expression for this in a particular coordinate system. And given that it's going to be a tensorial expression, will tell me that the result that I worked out, even though I relied on a specific coordinate system, has to be true for all coordinates. So that's the easy way, and we'll do it like that. So to calculate delta r alpha beta, work in, well, for example, Riemann norm coordinates at P, work in local Lorentz frame at P, where the metric at P is going to be Minkowski, and most importantly, the connection at P is going to be zero. So I'm going to use star whenever I refer to that specific coordinate system. And what I'm going to do is to work out delta r in the coordinate system. So remember what delta r is. Well, remember what the Ricci tensor is. So schematically, again, Ricci or Riemann can be expressed as two terms involving the derivative of the connection. Those I can't make equal to zero. I mean, I don't have the freedom to do that when I work in the local Lorentz frame. So I have two terms like this, and then I have two terms involving gamma squared. And those can be set equal to zero. When I vary r, that means that I differentiate the variation and the action. We have to distinguish the symbols here. And for the rest of it, well, I'm going to get twice gamma delta gamma minus twice gamma delta gamma. And the beauty of working at P is that I don't have to work out those terms. I can throw them out, and we will. So now I'll do the indices. I'll insert the indices. So for the Ricci scalar, the Ricci tensor, if I'm working at P, what we have is, I need to look up the indices here. We have delta mu, gamma mu alpha beta, minus delta beta, gamma mu, mu alpha. So that's what happens to the Riemann tensor when you, you contract all the indices to go from Riemann to Ricci, and that's what happens when you throw away the gamma squared terms that we don't need for this calculation. So the variation in Ricci then becomes, in the same coordinate system, a derivative with respect to mu of delta gamma minus that variation of gamma. And here is where it gets really nice. this is a tensor. I'm differentiating a tensor with partial derivative operator. I can replace the partial derivative operator by a covariant derivative operator. And because I'm working at P, there's no distinction between because all the gamma terms are zero. So the next step is to replace the partial derivatives by covariant derivatives, recognizing that in this coordinate system, there's no difference. But now we have a tensorial result. The left-hand side is a tensor. The right-hand side is the covariant derivative of a tensor. It's also a tensor. And equality between two tensors, if you establish it in one coordinate system, it has to be true in all coordinates. Therefore, at this stage, I can remove the star because I've established tensorial identity between the variation of Ricci and the variation of the connected, which itself is the tensor field, as I said before. So bottom line is that in any coordinate system, we have this identity. If you wanted to do it the hard way, what you would do is to keep all the gamma squared terms, and what would happen then is that as you take variations, you would have a whole bunch of gamma terms that would come along for the ride. And what would happen is that all of those partial derivatives and all of those gamma terms would naturally combine to form covariant derivatives. So you would end up exactly with the same result, obviously. But this is the easy way. You don't have to keep track of all the gamma terms, and it comes out immediately. And, you know, it's a much faster way to get the result. Okay, so we're going to need to insert that into the boundary integral, and what I need to do first is to contract the indices with G. So what we want is the trace of that. So I'm going to be working on this. All right. So let's consider what we actually need inside the integral, which is the trace of what I just wrote down. And what I can do, so covariant derivatives and metrics commute. So I can insert the metric inside the covariant derivative and write the first term in this form. And the second term, what I want to do here, I want to, well, also insert it. So here I have del beta, and I have g alpha beta delta gamma mu alpha. Beta here is the dummy index. I'm going to rename it mu. But I have to be careful because I've already selected mu over here, but that's also a dummy index, so I'll just call it mu. And what I wanted to establish here is that, well, this whole trace thing is actually a pure divergence. And it's a divergence of some quantity that I'll call delta v mu, and delta v mu is actually defined to be, well, what's inside the bracket in each case. And the fact that it's pure divergence, of course, is the thing that allows us to put that second integral to push it all the way out to the boundary. So any technical issues here? You're all with me.
All right. So let's integrate this, and then you know use Gauss's theorem to evaluate the integral on the boundary. So what we had to evaluate was the volume integral of g alpha beta dr
alpha beta integrated over the original volume element. And then what we find is that, well, this is the volume integral of the pure divergence, which means that we can actually use Gauss's theorem and evaluate this on the boundary. And what we have to do is to evaluate something like this on the boundary. Now, that's my surface element on the boundary. And here what I'll do is to write it in terms of the normal vector and the usual measure on the surface. So what we have really here is an integral over the boundary. There's an epsilon term that, if you go back to your notes, comes from converting the surface element delta sigma into something involving the normal vector. So that's where epsilon comes in. And what we do is to take this quantity delta v defined here. We take its normal component, and then we integrate over the three-dimensional volume. As a technical assumption here, I'm assuming that there's no place where the boundary is actually null, that we just complicated situation. So I'm assuming that I go from a time-like segment to a space-like segment to another time-like segment without null segments. So if you have sharp corners in the boundary, you might end up with little problems in defining the normal vector there. But you can always round up, round the corner. And here there might be one point where it's sort of ambiguous, but because it's only a point and there's no sharp features, after integration they don't compute. So, yeah. So yeah, in all of those issues you have to worry about this mixing, but I won't. Okay. So now we have to do a little bit more work and try to evaluate this on the boundary and try to see, where this all leads us. So you'll have to bear with me a little bit longer. I said a few things about the boundary before, but let's recap a little bit. So on the boundary, we have that, well, the variation of the metric is zero, and also the variation of the inverse metric is zero. We can decompose the metric, as we learned how to do a while back, into the normal component and the transverse component. So what I can do is to decompose the metric on the boundary as something involving the normal direction. Let me do it with the indices up instead. I can decompose the metric, the inverse metric, in terms of the normal directions and then the tangential directions. So those are the completeness relations that we wrote down a while back. So these are the tangent vectors on the boundary. This is the normal vector on the boundary, and this is just the decomposition of the metric into normal components and tangential components. And to shorten the notation, I'll just call this whole thing H alphabet. And the understanding, of course, is that, well, because we have the variations of the metric on the boundary being zero, we also have the variation of H being zero and the variation of HAB being zero as well. Okay. So now I have to make things a little bit more explicit. I have to work on the variation of the connection. I have to evaluate this and see what comes out of all that. So schematically, when I calculate gamma, there's a factor of 1/2, there's an inverse metric, and then there are three terms that involve derivatives not variations of the metric. When I calculate the variation of the metric, and bear in mind that we're doing this on the boundary, I'm interested in evaluating all of this on the boundary. And the variation of the connection that I need to calculate here is the one that's evaluated on the boundary. When I calculate the variation of this, the first thing that I would need to do is to vary the first factor, which is the inverse metric, and then everything else would come along for the ride. And then the next thing I would have to do is to leave the inverse metric alone and vary the metric derivatives. And the point is that we're doing this on a boundary where the variation of the metric itself is zero. So the first term actually goes away. The second term doesn't go away because I'm not allowed to say that all derivatives of the metric vanish on the boundary. All of the tangential derivatives vanish because the metric is fixed on the boundary, but the normal derivative may not. So I can say that the metric derivatives in the tangential directions are zero. So that's what happens when I take a metric derivative and then I project it down to the boundary in the directions of the boundary, because the metric itself is fixed on the boundary. The variation will, you know, is zero everywhere on the boundary, therefore derivatives tangential to the boundary is zero. But what is not zero are the metric derivatives normal to the boundary. I don't know how the metric might change as I approach the boundary from the inside or out, as I, you know, as I change the metric going from inside to outside the boundary. I'm not allowed to restrict the variation of the metric derivatives in those directions. So that's where we have to keep close track of what happens here to make sure that we don't drop terms like that, even though we're allowed to drop terms like this. So here we have to exercise a little bit of care in order to make sure that we evaluate this properly. All right, so let's do it for real. So we have that the variation in the connection, G alpha beta gamma, is going to be 1 half G alpha mu. And then we have the variation in the metric G mu beta differentiated with respect to gamma. Then we have this term. Then we have the variation of G beta gamma differentiated with respect to mu. What we need to construct is, where am I? We have to go back here. What we need to construct is delta V and then evaluate it in the normal direction. So delta V, now I'm going to have to be very careful with the indices. We have G alpha beta that multiplies the Christoffel term. And let's see, I need the factor. So I have the factor of 1 half over here. I have G nu that will multiply delta G nu alpha beta, nu beta alpha minus alpha beta mu. So that's the first term. And I think I've placed all my indices correctly. And then we have the other term, which is G mu alpha. We have half G nu mu. And then what do we have? We have G mu, it's nu and alpha, nu alpha plus g nu alpha nu minus delta g nu alpha comma mu. Let's see.
But I hope that this simplifies.
And in order to reveal that, I'm going to have to probably relabel some indices. Let's see, how did I do that here? Right, so what I'm going to try and do is to factorize g alpha beta, g mu nu. And I'm going to just relabel all the dummy indices that I see here. So the first line I leave alone. But for the second line, I'm going to rewrite it with the change of indices. So what I've done is to change this mu into a beta. I did something really bad before. So that was a mu. This should have been a different dummy index. Because mu had to be reserved for the only free index we got here. I'm going to do something really offensive, which is to do it on the fly on the board. But anyway, if you get lost, you can just write down the final answer and just go through the steps by itself if you wish. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to relabel this alpha and call it nu. And I'm going to do it here, and here. And what I need to do, of course, is to change these guys into alpha and beta. So I had nu lambda. I'm going to change this nu into an alpha. Don't do this at home. I'm going to change the lambda to a beta. And we'll see if I land on my feet with that. Okay, so now I factorize everything, and I get delta g alpha beta comp nu plus minus g beta nu comp alpha plus g alpha nu comp beta. And let's see, do we have simplification? We do, because we get twice each term. This guy is the same as this should have been me. Those terms are equal. Those guys are equal, and those guys are equal. So let's see what we got. We got half g alpha beta g mu nu, except we've lost the factor of 1/2. And we get g nu alpha beta plus d nu beta alpha minus d g alpha beta comp nu. Okay. And I can simplify this even more, because here we have explicit symmetry with respect to alpha and beta. And here we have it also explicitly, and I can just save myself a little bit of writing by just collapsing those two terms. But there's no real need to do that, so I'll just leave it in that form. And yes, I got the right answer out of it. So write this down. It's correct. All right. Okay, so I have delta v. What I really need inside the integral is the normal component to that. So what I'm going to have here is g alpha beta, and nu, that multiplies delta g, g nu alpha comma beta plus delta g nu beta comma alpha minus delta g alpha beta comma nu. The next step is going to involve the decomposition of the metric, and then we're going to sort out which are tangential derivatives and which are normal derivatives. The metric is this plus this. We have the normal direction over here. And we have all the rest of it. All right. Okay, so let me split this into two explicit things. So we have all the normal things over here. And then we have the rest of it over here. All right. Here I have a derivative with respect to beta, but I'm multiplying by n. And that's a potential term that I need to keep because it's a normal derivative. And in fact, all of those guys are normal derivatives, so we have to pay close attention to them. And here, we have a derivative with respect to beta, but we're multiplying here by the induced metric. And the induced metric is made out of, where did I write it down? It's over here. So the induced metric involves the tangential vectors. So all of those terms here, except for the last one, involve normal derivatives. Tangential derivatives. So we can, in fact, get rid of those ones because, as always, we're evaluating all of this on the boundary, and we're allowed to say that the tangential derivatives of delta g are all zero. So we get simplification here. We get rid of all the tangential derivatives. Here, when you look at the first line, things are actually not bad because if you look at this combination here and look at alpha and nu, we see that we have something which is symmetric under the exchange of alpha and nu. But if you look at this term over here, you find that if you interchange alpha and nu, you get the minus sign and it's anti-symmetric. So for those last two terms, we get nothing because here we have an antisymmetric combination in nu and alpha that multiplies a symmetric combination in nu and alpha, and therefore we get cancellation. So in the end, we get something which is really not that bad. Somehow I wanted to get rid of the other one too. Oh, okay. I should have symmetrized when I had a chance because now it's going to get confusing. No. Okay, I got lost somewhere. there was some cancellation that occurred before that I didn't quite pick up, and that's the problem. Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is something that students sometimes do. When you ask them to prove a certain result, they do all sorts of wrong things, and then mysteriously the right answer occurs, you know, appears at the end because they know where it should be. So I'll do it here. So I think that there's some, you know, I think I got the indices wrong at some place, and I just didn't, you know, I didn't produce the right cancellations when I should have. And I apologize for all that, but anyway, I'm sort of stuck here. I would have to go back to the beginning in order to do this correctly, so I don't think I'll do that. Let me just, you know, boil it down to the correct final answer, because I know what it is, because, you know, when I did this last week, when I was preparing for this lecture, I actually did it correctly. But anyway, so the final answer involves only a normal component. All the tangential components have disappeared, and we end up with this expression right here, h alpha beta delta g alpha beta differentiated in the normal direction, which is something I almost had over here, except that I needed to get rid of that term as well, and the only thing that really survives in the end is that term that comes from over here. Okay, so let me just do maybe a couple of extra steps, and then I think we'll break, and I'll pick up the story after lunch. So where do we stand? Well, we've done a lot of work, so let me try to summarize where we stand with all this. We started out with a variation of the Hilbert term in the action. And the first thing that we got almost without having to do any work was the Einstein tensor inside the volume integral. And then we got the extra boundary term that, after fully working it out, gives that result over here. So as the boundary term, we get the factor of epsilon, which was there. We get a minus sign that that is there also. And now we get the inverse, the induced metric and the variation of the metric differentiated in the null direction, in the normal direction. And that's where we see that the variation of the Hilbert term all by itself doesn't do the right thing. Because in order to conclude that the variation of this being zero gives you the field equations, you would have to impose this extra condition that not only is the metric variation should vanish on the boundary, but also its normal derivative should vanish on the boundary. And this is the extra condition that I talked about before that we don't wish to impose, that would be an extension, or rather a restriction of the usual variational principle where you demand that the metric vanishes on a boundary, but not, you know, you don't make any more statements than that. So the idea of having to introduce the boundary term in the action is precisely to cancel that extra term. And you can sort of see that what we're going to need to remove this, we're going to need an extra term in the action. But because this undesirable term over here involves the normal derivative of the metric, you can see the connection with the extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic curvature is the normal derivative of the metric on the boundary. And what we have, in a sense, is its variation over here. So except for cleaning up the indices and making sure that everything works out and worrying about numerical factors, what we have here is precisely what, you know, should be coming from a variation of the extrinsic curvature on the boundary. The variation of the extrinsic curvature on the boundary is the same thing, essentially, as the variation of the normal derivative of the metric. And we're going to rebuild that when we come back this afternoon. And that's going to give us the extra term in the action that is required for a proper formulation of the variational principle. And that's why the gravitational action has to contain that boundary term to make everything just right. So I'll leave it for here. I apologize for getting messed up over here. Well, you know, the details are a little bit daunting, so when you do it quietly with pen and paper, it's easier than when you try to do it in front of a live audience on the blackboard. So, I think it's the sort of thing that you have to work through yourself anyway, and I encourage you to do that. But I'm going to pick up the story from here this afternoon. Any questions before we quit?
Yep. Presumably, before this boundary business came into play, we would just put the boundary at infinity and forget about it altogether, right?
If you read the old books, that's how it tends to be formulated. So you don't take a boundary, you know, explicitly into account. You think of formatting all of this, all of space-time. Therefore, you don't worry too much about what happens at infinity. However, you know, if you want to be a bit more precise and make sure that your integrals are always well defined, even when you take the limit where delta v goes to infinity, you have to make some statements about how the metric should behave at infinity. So an alternative to doing all of this is to not focus on details on the boundary, but you have to impose certain asymptotic flatness conditions on the metric, which are again extra conditions that are required for variational principles to be correct. So the point is that, you know, if you push the boundary to infinity, you would expect that the metric should fall off in a certain way. Otherwise, the integrals aren't going to be well behaved. And it turns out then to be necessary to impose a sort of flatness conditions on the metric at infinity, which again is more than specifying boundary values. It's formulating more conditions than you really need for proper formulation of the variation principle. So I think this is really the thing you can do. And the benefit of doing that is that while you have the boundary terms, that turn out to be important and informative. So it's a good idea to do it like this. So how much? Yeah?
Something that I just don't, when you take a class in like classical Lagrangian mechanics, to write down the Lagrangian is straightforward. You know, you find the kinetic and potential energies, and it's easy. But like, how do you know that's the Lagrangian, this funny looking thing? Like, where does it come from?
Right, so you need to be inspired. Right. And the way that, there are lots of different action principles that you can write down for GR. This is the cleanest one because it does involve a scalar quantity. There are non-scalar quantities that can be invented for Lagrangian density. But the point is that, well, essentially, you have to be inspired and you have to be guided by perhaps the final answer, which is the Einstein-Hill equations. In the case of Hilbert, well, his motivation was, what do I have at my disposal as candidates for Lagrangian density, knowing that I want it to be a scalar, that it has to involve the metric and its first derivatives? Well, if he had stuck to that, the answer would be, I have nothing at my disposal. There is no scalar quantity that can be formed from the metric and its first derivatives only, because that would mean taking the metric as a connection, trying to form a scalar out of that, and the connection not being a tensor spoils the whole program. So what Hilbert had to realize is that in order to get a good candidate for Lagrangian density, you had to involve the metric, the first derivatives, and the second derivatives. And if you wanted that to be a scalar, well, the only candidate he had was the Ricci tensor, the Ricci scalar that comes from the Riemann tensor, which is, you know, a tensor or quantity that involves those quantities. And once you said all this, well, the only ambiguity is, the numerical factor. And also, you can actually insert a term proportional to the metric, a constant, into the Lagrangian density, and that would give rise to approximate the constant term in the field equation. So you may or may not want to include this, but the point is that, you know, the requirement that you do have a scalar quantity is pretty restrictive if you want to limit yourself to second derivatives. If you want to go beyond that, or if you want to make things more complicated by looking at squares of Ricci or squares of Riemann and things like that, there are more candidates that you can form, but then they give rise to field equations that are much more complicated. And in fact, if you involve square quantities inside the Lagrangian, you would end up with fourth field equations of the fourth order. So so if you want the end result, so also the second order equations of the metric, that's all you got. The only freedom you really have, if you want to make alternative theories of gravity, is to insert additional fields. For example, scalar tensor theories, scalar vector tensor theories, that sort of thing. Did you have a question? Yeah.
I'll think about it again. I have one. May I ask?
Okay. All right. Let's have lunch.